Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves.
And I'm Don Bishop. We're your hosts for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we will be featuring Rene Lamaris, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the Siberian Taimen, the legend of Russia's rivers. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rene a question, just go to our homepage, www.askaboutflyfishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show, and we'll receive your questions immediately and try to answer as many of your questions live on the show as possible.
This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 1 hour after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of the broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form.
When we return, we will talk with Rene Lamaris about Siberian Taimen.
The R.L. Winston Rod Company is the maker of the revolutionary Boron 2X, the first and only fly rods that are both delicate yet powerful and weigh up to one-third less than any others. Second-generation boron graphite composite allows us to build lighter, more responsive rods while maintaining outstanding fish-fighting power. Go to your local fly shop and ask to cast the Boron 2X, offered in 3-3-6 weight. Then enter our Cast a Winston Sampler contest. You could win 6 Winston rods. Visit www.winstonrods.com for contest details and to locate the nearest Winston dealer. Cast a Winston at the best place possible, your local specialty fly shop. Before we introduce Rene, we'd like to let you know about the great gift we have to give away tonight. For our drawing, Rene has been kind enough to provide an autographed copy of his book, Alaska Fishing, The Ultimate Angler's Guide. The book is the most comprehensive guide to fishing the 49th state out there now, and this deluxe full-color edition covers all of Alaska's species, methods, and waters with contributions from Alaska's top fishing experts. We'll also be giving away 1 year's subscription to Fly Fusion, Canada's premier fly fishing magazine. So if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Rene's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form. We'll announce the winner at the end of the show.
Well, Rene Lamaris started out on the East Coast, and he picked up fly fishing at age 10. But he graduated from fishing for trout on spring creeks in Appalachia to the big waters and big country in Alaska in the 1970s. Once he was in the last American frontier, he guided on Lake Eliamna before establishing his guide service, Ultimate Rivers, in the 1980s. He first started fishing in Russia later in the 80s, and he since has led hundreds of trips to remote southeast Alaska and Russia's Far East since the early 90s. Rene has worn many hats thus far in his career. In addition to being an accomplished wilderness fishing guide, he's a photographer, outdoors author, editor, homesteader, and publisher. He lives near Anchorage, and his book, Alaska Fishing, The Ultimate Angler's Guide, now in its third edition, is considered by many to be the Bible on fishing the Great Frontier. His photography and articles have graced the major sporting magazines, and his seminars on fly fishing Alaska and Russia are in high demand. Tonight, we'll be hearing about some very exotic species of fish found in some incredibly remote parts of the world. It's all foreign to a lot of us, and Rene Lamaris is just the person to introduce us to this fascinating area. Welcome, Rene. Thanks for joining us tonight.
It's a real pleasure to be with you tonight. Thank you very much.
Well, Rene, you currently live and run your business from Chugiak, Alaska, which is just a few pine trees down from Anchorage, right?
Right, correct.
And why in the world would you want to go to Russia? Aren't there enough big fish in Alaska to fish for?
Well, this is true, but as anyone has fished here in the last 5 or 10 years has noticed that some of the better locations in Alaska are getting a little bit crowded, and we've always been interested in Russia simply because it was the last great place to go once we got established in Alaska and got familiar with some of the better fishing locations in southwest Alaska and some of the more remote parts of the state. We're always interested in opening up the last final frontier, which, you know, to us here in Alaska is merely a hop step away very close by air of travel, so it just was natural for us to develop and get over there and start to fish that region.
So Alaska is no longer the last frontier, right?
Well, it's all on your, develop your whole point of reference. I mean, for people who may, be familiar with just fishing in the urban landscapes and back east or those areas, and then, of course, Alaska and Canada would be, this is a whole another quantum leap beyond anything they can imagine. But, for someone who's been fishing up here for a while, even for people from out of state who come up here regularly, they've noticed the change and some of the more popular locations, just the amount of use that has really increased over the last, 10, 15 years or so. So, for all practical purposes, Siberia is the last final frontier for cold water fishing.
Well, let's talk more about that. Why don't we first start talking about taimen, the fish that we're centered around here tonight, and then we'll move into to a lot of other areas
sure.
that I know everybody's asked questions about. But let's just talk about the taimen itself. And we did put a picture out on your bio page on our website, so
mm-hmm.
if people want to go to Renee's bio page, they can see a picture of a taimen. But why don't you go ahead, Renee, and describe what a taimen looks like.
Well, if you can imagine, it's got a classic trout shape, with the only difference that generally a lot of the fish you catch, the smaller fish, are a little bit longer for their size, more elongate than than let's say a rainbow trout or a brown trout would be. We're basically talking about the classic trout shape. It's got a very large mouth, very sleek, slender body. It is a salmonid, so it has all the classical features that salmon and trout have, adipose fins, small scales. It's got markings on it. Coloration can vary anywhere from a kind of a tarnished silver to a bronze or even a greenish, lighter on the belly, and markings very similar to a coho or a king salmon, very sparse markings, generally more on the upper body than lower body, yellowish eyes, and a large gaping mouth, larger than any other fish other than let's say a northern pike, but certainly a larger mouth than let's say of king salmon or rainbow trout or brown trout. And,
well, Renee, we've heard legends about the taimen.
Can
you give us a sense of how big they get and how long they live?
Yeah, what makes taimen so unusual is that they're extremely long-lived. They're one of the most long-lived of all freshwater fish species. They can live over 100 years. And another interesting thing about the taimen is that they keep growing incrementally throughout their lifespan. There's no one period during their lives when they grow and they slow their growth at any period. As long as the food is available, they'll keep growing throughout their lifespan. So they can achieve quite a large size. Largest recorded specimens have been over 200 pounds. The largest recorded specimen was 243 pounds, taken to north central Siberia back in right after World War II. So they can achieve a larger size than the other salmonid.
What kind of lifespan then do they generally have?
Generally, if you catch a trophy specimen, will be as old as you are or older.
Wow.
Generally, so it's easy to tangle with fish that are over 100 years old, and any fish that's over 100 pounds is typically, depending on where you catch them, of course, some areas have faster growth rates than others because of the amount of food available. But generally, if you go trophy fishing and hook, like say, a 60, 70 pounder, that fish will probably be older than you are.
Wow.
Well, how'd you know Don was 100 years old?
Yeah.
You said it was old as he was, and you said 100, so I didn't know he was 100, but with that white beard, he might be. Well, what's the average, size of a taimen that you're catching?
Generally, we fish over in the Russian Far East in an area that has a really good food supply compared to other parts of the range. And average size between 20 and 30 pounds is the average fish we catch.
That's average.
Yeah.
Wow. And what is that in inches over there, so we can get an idea of?
Anywhere from let's say 36 to 48 inches, 42, 48 inches. Mm-hmm.
And a trophy then would be something over that then? Over
yeah, over 4 feet in length, and you know, anything over 60 pounds would be a really good fish.
Wow. Do we know any of the IGFA records on Tymon?
Most of the Tymon records, we set them early in our careers over there, and we weren't concentrating on we were just interested in developing programs. And so, you know, to be quite honest with you, even today, in the areas that we fish, they're really challenging fly fishing conditions. So we had people who were interested in getting in a record book no matter what, and so we had quite a few records set on all-tackle, IGFA all-tackle. We have the IGFA all-tackle record in several line classes, and we do have some tippet classes, but most of the tippet classes are still remain open, and quite a few have been set in other parts of Russia by some other people's programs, but there's still lots of opportunity for folks who want to take the time and the discipline to set tippet class records for IGFA for Siberian Tymon.
Well, Renee, these tell us a bit more about the Tymon itself. Are these predators looking for meat? Do they take
insects? Yeah, they're really interesting fish, and they're the fish that kind of got the whole thing started for people wanting to go over and fish those areas because of the reports that had come in after World War II about these giant fish. But basically what they are is they're kind of a relic species. Back in the evolution of salmon and trout, they speculate that at one point these fish were the precursors of all salmon, trout, and char evolution. And due to the fact that Siberia, unlike North America, had vast areas of it that were unscathed by the glaciers during the last periods of glaciation, these fish survived as a relic species. And so they're kind of like a prehistoric progenitor of all the salmon and trout. And so they have some features that are really interesting in terms of their, you know, their behavior and the way they eat and everything. But primarily they're piscivores. When they get older, they concentrate on large fish. And the rivers of Siberia have a great diversity of bait species, whitefish, and quite a few species of white. In fact, more species of whitefish in over there than in North America. Species of carp-like fish. So there's all kinds of there's amazing diversity of bay fish over there. So they primarily live on fish species, but as they get larger, they've been known to take ducks and mammals, and even according to legend, small children have been swallowed by these things, according to folklore over there. So anyway, it's real interesting. But yeah, as they get larger, then their ability to eat other things other than fish increases.
The time in their life span when they take insects?
The small ones may do that, but they quickly they're just, you know, hardwired to go after, you know, the bigger meals of in the water column. So the small ones will take insects, and you can catch them a real small fish like you know, a foot or two or something in these areas where the small ones live, the, you know, little Tymon nurseries. In the shallows of small little creeks and stuff, but pretty much anything of any size is going to be geared up to eat the fish, to devour mm-hmm. fish. So,
are they primarily solitary individuals?
Yeah, they are. When they get larger, they are. You will never encounter. They're very territorial. The really large ones become extremely territorial to the point where if you were, say, fishing a river like the Yenisei River or the Lena River or some tributary of that, and you got into a big hole or big area, that would typically be ruled by one large fish who might, you know, work an area, you know, about 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 miles or so of river, and that would be his area. And so it's really interesting because the locals will actually, you know, after a while they identify these particular fish, they give them names. And they live from, you know, actually where, you know, situations where one guy's grandfather's been fishing this one particular fish and his dad fished it and he's fished it. No one's ever been able to land this thing because it just got so smart over a period of 120 years or whatever.
Gee, man, Christmas.
Generations, yeah.
Now, when you say, you know, do they consider that hole their home base? I know. You know, you're telling.
Well, they are migratory, and I shouldn't make a. Listeners aware of the fact that there are, several species of Tymon, and there's a sea run form, and that goes out to sea. It's an anadromous. And my primary focus and most of my experience has been with the river resident form, which spends its entire life in fresh water. And they are migratory, much like other salmonids, where depending on what time of year you fish from, they'll be located in certain areas. But they do have a home stretch of water that they like to inhabit during most of the year. But they do move around, though. They spawn, and they're spring spawners, and they do move around according to where the food is located.
Well, that's what I was kind of getting at.
Yeah,
they've
right.
got kind of a home area where everybody knows they are, but they may go at night and go
yeah,
fishing.
Yeah, and that also depends on where you catch them. Now, for instance, we fish in the Russian Far East, tributaries of the Lower Amur River, and these taimen are feeding very heavily during the summer and fall months on chum salmon. And so they're going to be basically positioning themselves in the lower parts of these tributaries to catch this annual run of salmon. The Amur River has the largest run of and the most prolonged run of chum salmon in the world. So these fish are going to move and position themselves to make themselves best able to catch these chums that come up. But if you go over to, like, say, the Yenisei River, the upper Yenisei, or some of these rivers where fish are more feeding on the local forage, the bay fish and so forth, tend to be a lot more less mobile and be found in one area than these fish that are basically a more opportunist and feeding on a particular food source that's available and located at some strategic area during the year. So.
Well, with the different forms of the taimen, what is their total area of distribution?
They're found from Eastern Europe, from the headwaters of the Danube River, and they're called Hütchen over there. They've been fished for hundreds of years. The Europeans there have a tradition, and they're a highly regarded fish, even raised in hatcheries in that part of Europe. And then they're found across Siberia into Mongolian northern China, and then there's a subspecies that's found even in North Korea, and then they're found along the coast of, from Hokkaido down to northern Korea, Sakhalin Island. There's that sea run form. So there's essentially four major species. Two of them, I believe, are sea run, and then the Hütchen and the Siberian taimen, which is found across Siberia. And the Siberian taimen gets a lot larger than the Hütchen.
The Hütchen is where now, in Mongolia?
It's found in Eastern Europe, yeah. Headwaters
of
the Danube River and a few of the other rivers there. And the Siberian taimen, because of the fact that, it's found across Siberia and the rivers. Now, these fish are large main-stem river habitat as their preferred habitat. So, naturally, with the rivers of Siberia are so large that it offers them an opportunity to get so much bigger in physical size because of the amount of food and forage. And so they're a lot larger, the Siberian taimen, than the Hütchen are. And they're slightly different. Some of the physical characteristics are slightly different too.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much about people fishing
yeah.
those in Europe. I don't.
Yeah.
Is it a sport fish there that's targeted, or is it?
Yes, they are, and they have been targeted for generations. And there's kind of like a devout group of anglers. These different angling clubs and so forth that pursue these Hütchen, and they have records and all this other stuff. And they even have hatcheries too. They regard them so highly that they have a fish propagation for them.
When you mentioned a minute ago about the chum salmon, now I fished
yeah.
for chum up in Alaska.
Right.
The chum I was were catching were usually about 10 to 12 pounds or so.
Right, right.
Is that the same size fish that?
They're a little bit smaller on the Amur. They're about 7 or 8 pounds.
That's still
so
a pretty
still
big lunch.
That's still a hefty fish for some other fish to swallow, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. It sure
yeah.
is. Sure is. Well, let's talk about the early days and going over there, because it hasn't, there's people my age, of course, can remember when you didn't go to Russia.
Right,
and,
I remember too, yep.
Yeah, so, in fact, when I lived in Alaska, when I was a youth, my father monitored communications from the Russians and so forth. It was all during
the Cold War.
Cuban,
Yep, right.
Situation and so forth. So it was quite tense when I lived in Alaska.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you get started over there? What were the beginning days like? And tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it was real interesting. You know, naturally, you know, growing up in the Cold War, like you, I had a tremendous curiosity to about the Soviet Union. It has a tremendous amount of mystery and mystique to associated to it. Russia does, and when I, you know, got settled in Alaska, started fishing in Alaska, it was, you know, we were obviously a little bit closer to Russia, but the real break came back in the late 70s. There were some some newspaper articles that somehow leaked out from into some of the major West Coast newspapers about some giant fish that some scientists were studying in northern China that came out right before earthquakes. And it sounded like a fable that there were these some remote lakes in northern China where these things came out right before an earthquake, and the article said they were reported to reach lengths of 20 feet. And you know, you're reading this article and you're going, what the heck is going on? I mean, this has got to be a hoax. And then sure enough, not too long after, there were some follow-ups to that article saying that the researchers, these scientists, Chinese scientists, said that these fish may be some form of taimen, which were, you know, a group of, you know, salmon, part of the salmon trout char family that can reach lengths of, you know, up to 9 or 10 feet. And so, you know, reading these other follow-up articles, it you know, it was easy to surmise that there was something going on over there. There was some fish that was really interesting and worth looking into. So that article, or some of those articles, were drawn up to my attention from some of my buddies, fly fishing buddies, and we did some poking around, contacted some scientists, and found out that indeed there were some fish over there that were found only over there, that were supposedly, you know, these members of the salmon trout family and got up to be over 200 pounds. And so, you know, our curiosity was really piqued. And at the same time that all this was going on, the Iron Curtain was starting to thaw out. A lot of things were going on with this. This was like during the 80s. So, you know, things were looking a little bit more favorable toward some kind of a tourist effort, a sport fishing effort. And concurrently, at the time, I was getting involved just out of you know, my interest in fly fishing. A good friend of mine was involved in international whitewater rafting competitions, which are held annually all around the world in these prestigious locations, whitewater rivers. And he got at one of some of the rallies they had in Central Asia, he got to know the Russian rafting team and was able, through his contacts here and through his he knew I was real interested in getting some kind of a program, exploratory thing going over there. We were able to negotiate through the Soviet Peace Committee, which basically was a branch of the KGB. They were real interested in finding out what you know, they just couldn't believe that Americans would want to go over to Russia and just sport fish. They thought there was some kind of ulterior motive. We were interested in looking at their military installations or something. But so they put these first initial trips together just more out of curiosity to see if indeed we were in earnest, and would pay that kind of money. Clients, you know, Americans would pay that kind of money and go that far to just go after some will-o'-the-wisp called a time in. And so that's how the first trips came about. They were really groundbreaking efforts, and the Russians did all they could to provide us with a fantastic experience. And we got to fish areas that no one had ever really fished before. They're very remote parts of Siberia. And so anyway, they were real special experiences for everyone involved, and they laid the groundwork then for our you know, early time and program, sport fishing program.
Renee, let's take a brief break here. When we return, we'll be talking more with Renee about the early days of fishing the Siberian taimen.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Renee Lamaris about Siberian taimen, The Legend of Russia's Rivers. If you'd like to ask Renee a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Below the description of the show that says click here to ask Renee your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately and try to answer as many as your questions live on the show as possible. Renee, could you give us just a little bit of background information on your business, your guide service, and contact information?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Name of my our company is Ultimate Rivers, and we're on the web at ultimaterivers.com. And we're based out of here, out of Chugiak, which is north of Anchorage. And our scope of our sport fishing operation encompasses most of southwest Alaska and the Russian Far East. I do trips. We do the Siberian timer trips, and we also do trips for rainbow trout and on the Kamchatka Peninsula. And our phone number is area code 907-688-6535.
Great.
Good, Renee. And you also, as we will talk about later, your book is available on
I'm sorry. So. Alaska Fishing, The Ultimate Angler's Guide. Yeah.
Terrific, terrific. Yeah. And you've also got some articles on time in there and so forth that people
right.
can read, which I think is real interesting about the early days over there. So you got a kind of a door opened over there.
Yeah, right.
What were those early trips like? What were we talking about, first of all, in Russia?
Yeah.
How did you get there?
Well, basically, initially, you know, for those early trips, you had to fly to Moscow, and all the trips were based out of Moscow. And so typically East Coast people wouldn't have any trouble making a connection, like, say, JFK to Moscow. West Coast people would be a little bit longer to get there, but most of the trips were based out of Moscow, and we were fishing Central Siberia, North Central Siberia, and you know, basically we were just kind of just it was like taking shots in the dark. You know, we were just going by the recommendations of our Russian contacts to what would be the best areas to fish, and quite often we came up empty-handed sometimes in terms of the results weren't as what we had planned. In terms of sometimes we'd get the timing wrong or the conditions weren't favorable for fishing and that sort of thing. But so we were kind of just poking around just different parts of Russia, trying to just go on hunches or what we had talked to Russians about and gotten information from beforehand. So it was more hit or miss, and until we finally got settled into Russia's Far East, which is a lot closer for us, you know, which is right a few hours flight across from Anchorage, and that worked out a lot better for us. The fishing was consistent, the level of services that we could provide people with was a lot more available, so it was just easier to do trips out of Russia's Far East than to go through Moscow. But initially, back in the old days of the Soviet Union, all the trips were, because they were handled, you know, everything was a lot more regulated than before. Things opened up over there, so they pretty much had to require that we go through Moscow, and everything was handled by the Soviet Peace Committee. And once Glasnost took over and things opened up, then things became a lot more freer, and we were able to just, you know, travel a lot more easier throughout Russia. So it worked out a lot better that way.
Well, and could you maybe describe just a little bit how the trip runs in these days, since you don't have the KGB looking over your shoulder?
Oh, no, it's a lot more. Basically, what we were able to do was as things opened up in Russia and a whole new breed of young entrepreneurs developed through the onset of capitalism. You know, as opposed to, you know, back in the old days, we were dealing with some of these. In fact, to be quite honest with you, the people that we did business with initially on those first trips were the same people that had been these same organizations that had been taking cosmonauts and military top brass and all these other people out on the rivers and haven't shown them a good time, if you know what I mean. Whereas as things moved on, we were able to connect with people who had legitimate enterprises, young, very very sharp people that we helped get set up in business. And in turn, they provided us with a real high level of quality and service. And so typically our program is kind of a hybrid that kind of encompasses some of the better, best features that we've developed in our Southwest Alaska program with some of the better features that we've found that the Russians have come up with. You know, the Russians have their own style of doing river trips, and some of the things about that style are very, very endearing and very, very, very efficient. So we stay, we kind of make a hybrid program with what they have and what we've been able to bring through our years of doing trips in Southwest Alaska.
Well, now, Renee, we're talking about Eastern Siberia now is where you're doing your trips, right?
Russian Far East.
Now, that is just, what, the other side of Kamchatka, the Kamchatka Peninsula there?
That's considered part of it, but basically it encompasses, Russia's Far East encompasses everything from the Chinese border up to, Anadar, up to the northeastern, in other words, it encompasses parts of Russia that wouldn't be considered Siberia.
Okay.
And so we do the time and trips based out of Khabarovsk, which is a city near the lower Amur River. So.
And is that where you fly into initially?
That's where you fly into, yeah, from the west coast. Yeah, you can fly in from the west coast or from Alaska.
And what time of year is best to go?
Basically you've got the two best windows for fishing are in the spring or in the fall. And by spring, typically late May, June, or fall, which would be September, October, are the two best times to fish.
Renee, can you give us a bit of a rundown about how one might make travel arrangements and what kind of accommodations they have along the way?
There are two ways to go. The most direct route, for people on the West Coast, would be to fly through Seoul, Korea, and then make a connection. Depending on when you leave, you can go without any layovers right through the Khabarovsk. And then if you do have a layover, you can have accommodations in either Seoul, Korea for a night. Depending on what day you leave. But there's two or three airlines that service Seoul, Korea with connections to Khabarovsk. And Khabarovsk is about 3 hours from Seoul, 2.5-3 hours from Seoul. So typically you can make that connection without a layover and into Khabarovsk. And then that's where we helicopter out of Khabarovsk to the headwaters of these rivers that we float and fish.
Could you spell the name of that town? I'm not sure I'm hearing it well.
Yeah, it's Khabarovsk. Khabarovsk is how that's pronounced in Russian.
Got it. Well, what kind of equipment then is one bringing on a trip like this?
In terms of fishing gear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What we've found over the years is that obviously these are not small fish. So what it comes down to is you want to bring, the largest rod, single-handed rod you can comfortably fish with, for an extended period of time, whether that is, a 10, 11 or something, depending on what your wrist size is and your strength. But if you've thrown a big rod around for a while, you know how tiring that can be, a single-handed rod. So it's even better if people get adept and bring spey rods.
Uh-huh.
Most of our most successful fishermen have used spey rods simply because, depending on what time of year you fish and where you fish, of course, the spey rod gives you some real great advantages to fish because it is big water fishing.
What kind of cost is one looking at for a trip like this?
Most of the trips that we do are, because of their expeditions. So they're generally between 9, 10, or 12-day expeditions. And the cost varies anywhere from $3,600 to $4,500 from Russia. So,
okay.
For those trips, yeah.
So that's from Khabarovsk.
From Khabarovsk, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That adds up then by the time one travels.
Right.
Is it possible to catch favorable fares for the flights over?
Yeah, it is. You can. Depending on when you buy the tickets and how you buy them, I've heard of guys getting tickets from the West Coast to Khabarovsk for as low as like $900 round trip. So, it depends on when and how you buy the tickets, I suppose. On the internet and there's specials that come up, and when you buy the tickets and the time of year you fly and everything like that. But typically, you'll be looking at anywhere from $1,200 to $1,800 to get over there from the West Coast.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when you're out in camp and on the expedition, what are the accommodations there?
Basically, our timing program, it depends on what river we're doing, but our classic timing program that we offer for people who don't have any special, we have special rivers, where we do exploratory trips, and we have a trophy program, but what we've done is we're able to kind of feature the best parts of a float trip with the stays at camps, where basically we're floating down fishing, and then on the upper part of these rivers, and staying at these hunting camps, either like these little log cabins and stuff. And then when we get down to we have a main base camp at the end of the trip. We stay there for about 4 days, and we fish out of boats. The lower part of the river, simply because when you get down to the lower parts of these tributaries, the water becomes so large, you just really can't effectively fish it from raft. You have to have a motorboat. So we base the last part of the trip. We base out of this comfortable base camp, and we fish every day with boats. So it's kind of an interesting kind of a combination float trip, camping, motorboat fishing trip. So that's a longer trip, our 12-day trip.
Well, what's a normal day like then? Once you get, you come in on the helicopter and...
We set up camp and float and we don't do, we guys fish out of the boats. We found that, as soon as we get a good fish on, the first thing we're going to do is get a guy on shore so we can play the fish on shore, and then just have the boat ready. If it gets away from them, we'll chase after it in the boat. But generally, we're up early, like about 8 o'clock or so. The Russians do a real nice job on the camps. They set up all the camps and they do all the cooking. And after breakfast, we get in we have kind of a leisurely breakfast, and then we get in the boats around a river by 9 or 10, and we're floating and fishing. And we break for lunch about 1 or so, and have a real nice lunch, and then typically you're off the river by 5, set up evening camp about 5, and people can fish in the evenings. We always set up camp in a good area to fish, so there's a lot of fishing time for folks on those trips.
And we had a question here, Renee, from Bob in Chicago. He said he'd like to hear more about Russia. Do you actually have much contact with the local citizens? You did mention the guides are Russian, correct?
Yeah, we use all Russian guides, and part of the trip, after we get done with the fishing part of the trip, we spend some time just showing people what the Russian culture is like, and we give people a chance to experience some of the big city culture there. We do spend a day in Khabarovsk, touring the local museums and art gift shops and so forth, so people get a chance to see what that's like, and we take them to a real nice restaurant in town. But we do spend a lot of time then out in these villages, which to me is what the real Russian culture is all about. You get a chance to meet with the people who live out in the country and see how they all grow their own food, and they're real hospitable, and we just have a really good time, and just show people a lot of it, real interesting things,
Sure. So are there any seasons that you just absolutely don't go?
Well, we fished up until late fall, and even we fished for them when the snow's on the ground. But it's the limitations are similar to that in fishing in Alaska. I mean, you reach a point where it's kind of diminishing returns. I don't know if you guys have been on any real late season trips up here, but the mornings keep getting longer and longer around the fire in the morning. The colder it gets, because guys are warming their toes up, and you reach a point where you're not doing a lot of fishing. You're spending most of the time just in camp. So I would basically, we pretty much end our season at the end of October. So.
And what's the best time of year to go?
That depends. They're spring spawners, and so one of the advantages about fishing in the spring is that you're able to find them right after they spawn. They're concentrated in these tributaries, And so that's one of the few times in a year when you actually have a chance of hooking, you know, a lot of big fish. If you fish during the summer months or at other times of year, the larger fish are real territorial and are more spread out. So it's never really been a numbers game in terms of big fish, but your chances of hooking a lot more fish, big fish, are definitely greater during the spring, like May and June. But the problem with May and June, of course, is the water levels. You can get to fluctuating water levels because of runoff. So it's much the same as fishing, doing an early season trout trip here in Alaska. You've got the possibility of some really great fishing, but then, you know, depending on what kind of spring you have and how much snowpack, the water conditions can make it really difficult to fish. So now fall is another good time to fish too. From late August into October is another really good time to fish. A lot of big fish are taken then. Their fish are starting obviously to get ready for winter, so they're taking on a lot more food and they're a lot more aggressive. So that's, you know, and it's also a real pretty time of year to be out fishing. So that's always been my favorite time to fish, is in the fall.
Okay. Well, let's take just a very brief break, and when we return, we'll be answering more of your questions about the fly fishing trips for Siberian taimen, the world's largest trout.
Jaeger's Fly Shop is your sponsor for this segment of our show. Been online since 1998. Tim and Deb Jaeger operate their brick-and-mortar shop in Lawrence, Kansas, loaded with the best brands such as Sage, Scott, Ross, Sims, and much more. Nestled in the heart of Big Bass Country, Jaeger's offers a full-line pro shop and guide service where you can enjoy the beautiful Kansas Flint Hills and catch trophy bass. Tim and Deb offer the friendliest of customer service whether you walk in the door or order online. Place your order on their fully secured website, and it usually ships the same day. Mention this ad and receive 10% off your next web order. You can reach Jaeger's toll-free at 866-359-7467. That's 866-359-7467. Or on the web at www.jaegersflies.com. Jaegersflies.com.
And you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Renee Lamaris about Siberian taimen. You can ask Renee a question by going to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and clicking on the link below the description of the show. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we're trying to answer as many questions live on the show as possible.
Well, Renee, let's get into more into the equipment. You started to talk about the size rods and so forth. Can you talk about what you use for a line and leader setup when you're fishing for the taimen?
Yeah, sure. I wanted to just kind of just mention that there are two basic methods of fishing for these things in terms of your presentation, and we do take them on the surface, and we also do most of our fishing is below surface, and naturally, you know, depending on what method how you're going to go after them to determine your setup, but typically for a surface presentation, you'd be using a performance taper floating line. Depending on whether you're using a single-handed or a spay rod. And you have to use a real stout leader and tippet. And since they have two rows of teeth, sharp teeth, almost all our fishing we do is with wire leaders. And if you're going to go for an IGFA record, then there's a real specific setup you'd want to use for to ensure that your tippet class is still valid. But generally, we would use wire leaders tied into I use 50-pound Maxima for my butt section. You want to use a real strong, very hard mono leader, whatever brand you use. It's one of the reasons is not just for the fact that the taimen have these sharp teeth, but this kind of fishing is really, we're fishing in rocks. It's really rough on the line, so you want to use a really hard, stiff mono for your butt section. Typically, some of the fly patterns we use are we started out using for our surface presentation. It was kind of funny. We had the Russian, I need to back up a bit and talk a little bit about how the Russians fish for them, because it is kind of interesting. But Typically, Russians have a tradition of fishing these things with surface presentations, not so much on fly rods, but on these real primitive spinning rods. And what they'll do is generally use a carve a plug, a big surface plug, or tie something out of leather to imitate a muskrat or something on the surface of the water.
Oh.
Yeah, and then cast this big thing out, and they fish for them at night, late at night, in the dark. No self-respecting Russian would fish for them during the day. And quite typically, when I say late, I mean like 10 or 11 o'clock at night, sitting around the campfire when you're ready to go to sleep. After endless round of vodka, they'll announce that fish for time, and then you file it, you know, go single file down into the river, and you'll get in this boat, and they use these long, really long, tippy boats. They're about 24 feet long, so you have to kind of just hang on there, and they'll get you down to some spot on the river, some gravel bar or something like that, and some point in the river, and you'll get out, and they won't let you use any flashlights. No lights are allowed. Because the big time in our real light sensitive, and they do come out in the evenings at night. You can hear these fish splashing in the shallows. It's really something to be on these rivers. It's real exciting, almost spooky sometimes too. And so, taking from that tradition, trying to develop some kind of a methodology for fly fishing, we tried to started fishing with these large surface patterns to imitate the rodents and stuff, and I kind of came from this mentality that larger was the better, so I would actually get these things like squirrel or little squirrel skins from up here, red squirrel and even weasels, and skin them out and tie these monstrous creations, which were very effective in terms of, you know, what they were trying to imitate, but they were impossible to cast.
Yeah.
We have since gone kind of downsized everything and had a lot of luck with articulated leech patterns for subsurface patterns, and also for our surface patterns using a kind of a lemming, a much more tamed down version. I have some of the original things we tied on the wall, and I should get a picture because it's really amazing. Some of the first patterns they're like nightmarish creations, you know, but. So, you know, they were fished maybe once or twice, and we realized that it just wasn't going to work. You can't cast these things, especially at nighttime. You know, it's suicide to have this big thing whizzing through the air, you know, with a six-odd hook
sure.
In the dark. So, you know, what I would say to folks is, you know, you can use, if you've got setups that you've used for, like, say, you know, some of your saltwater setups would certainly work over in Russia for time, and like a tarpon setup or something like that. You know, rod tarpon rod.
Yeah.
Although, like I did stress that because of you know, the difficulty of casting repeatedly with a real large single-handed rod, that we've seen guys who can spay cast do a lot better over there. With stay rods, simply because they can work the rods, work the water a lot better than you can with a single-handed rod.
Sure. Well, you're fishing generally big water. And
big water.
I'm,
it's big
I'm
water
guessing,
fishing. Yep.
I'm guessing there's a lot of vegetation along the banks, so it's probably a pretty ideal setup for stay, isn't it?
Yeah, and in a lot of spots that we're fishing, yeah, that's correct. And that's one of the big advantages of stay rods, is you can do a roll cast and get out without the back cast.
Yeah.
And so we you know, I've been on lots of trips where the guys with the stay rods are the only guys who can fish a stretch of water effectively. So, you know, there's some real advantages to using the stay rods. And another nice thing about the stay rod is your line control, too. You have much better line control with the longer stay rod. So
yeah.
There's some real advantages to that. So, you know, what I try to do, recommend to folks, you know, more and more guys are getting into spay fishing, but, you know, I would highly recommend anyone who is planning to really go after time and to practice, you know, get a spay rod and practice or spay fishing. 11 to 13 weights would be the size I'd recommend for time and fishing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Renee, Josh Parks in West Virginia asks, you know, what are your favorite flies for tying in? What size do you tie them in?
Yeah,
real big at first, but
yeah, we've tamed it down now to basically we use like a 6-odd Gamakatsu, and we some of my lemming patterns tied with rabbit fur or bucktail or I you tie them like tandem using a tandem hook setup, but a lot of single hook flies, articulated leeches. Another fly that works really well is a real large oversized deceiver works really good. That's another really good pattern. But generally, anything that's, you know, what you're trying to do is imitate a large forage fish, so, or a rodent. So, depending on what your strategy is, whether you're going to fish surface or a subsurface presentation, you'll want to basically tie something that either imitates a fish or a rodent. I know in Mongolia that some of the operators over there use this kind of thing that imitates a, I think it's a ground squirrel or something like that. But the problem that there, like I mentioned earlier, is that the larger flies get really, especially when they're wet, get really difficult to pick up off the water and cast. So you want to just keep that in mind before your imagination runs wild with the on the fly time pinch that you got to cast this thing when it's wet and in the dark too. So yeah,
that's impressive. Well, in terms of going after these fish, is there any real constant in terms of the type of water that they hold in or that you're working?
Well, you know, depending on when you fish, if you do fish in the spring, then they're going to be found shallow in these tributaries. But generally, you know, during the summer and fall, they're going to be in, you know, near, associated with large main stem river habitat. And depending on where you fish them, of course, now, you know, were we fishing in these rivers along the Far East, and this would certainly hold true for the sea run tarmon as well, is that these fish are basically, you know, in these river, and they're going to feed on these anadromous fish species. So they're going to position themselves, you know, at the mouth of these tributaries, any areas where these, that, you know, that provide natural ambush sites for them, you know. But when we're doing, like, say, a typical flow trip, when we put in up on top in the shallower waters, you do encounter fish up there, but they're few and far between, and generally not as large as the fish that are found down below. And so you're always looking toward the larger kind of main stem river habitat, brush piles and holes, any areas that would provide the kind of cover they need, because they work best as ambush predators. And then of course when you fish them at night, then during the night they can be found anywhere in the shallows. You can hear them splashing around, chasing schools of fish up into the shallows. So generally, you know, basically what you do is you go locate, you know, yourself in an area where they're found, of course, but also down in a larger main stem habitat where the really big fish are found. And then depending on when you want to fish them, like I said, if you fish them at night, the big fish can be found just about anywhere. But they are light sensitive. So, you know, we've had good luck on cloudy days, early in the morning, fishing some of the deeper lies. Where normally, you know, if it was a bright sunny day, you wouldn't be fishing. But you know, later on in the late summer, early fall, on cloudy, overcast or rainy days, early in the morning, late in the evening, you can do well in some of these more traditional areas.
Well, when you're taking a group over there and guiding them,
right?
You said normally your day was kind of banker's hours out there,
right.
But so during the day you're catching fish, but those are the smaller fish then?
Yeah, quite typically, you know, during the course of like, say, a day floating fishing, you know, you've got guys catching, you know, 20, 30-pounders, maybe a 40 or 50-pounder. But, you know, it's generally understood that unless you, you know, make an effort, like when we get down to the bottom of the rivers, let's say on that trip I was describing where we fish out of that base camp in the morning, you know, when we get down to the bottom of the river to the really big water, we'll be getting up really early and going to some of these areas that the Russians know these big fish are hanging out in, or we'll set of, you know, let the people know that, you know, we're going to go fishing late that night. So then we might let guys sleep in that morning, okay? if we're going to plan on fishing late that night, because we know the guys are going to be up late that night. So we kind of plan our strategy to give them at least, you know, two nights of fishing, you know, night fishing, and then also hit early in the morning as well. And then if they want to fish during the day, depending on what the weather is, if it's a cloudy, overcast day, they can. And you can always catch smaller time and during the day. But typically, you know, the larger fish, you know, are fished either at night or early in the morning or late in the evening. So,
does it end up being sight fishing at all, or mainly are you working?
It can be on the upper part of the rivers, or if you fish in the springtime, you can actually see these taimen. But, you know, you have to be very careful. They're real spooky, and depending on where you're fishing and what the light is doing, you can actually sight fish these things, and that's really exciting when you can sight fish these things, you know. To see this thing come after your lure, I mean, it's just the most astounding thing. I mean, do you think a northern pike is something that to watch go after a hungry taimen is just awe-inspiring to watch these things go after a lure or a fly. It's just it's really something. But you know, typically most of the time you are not sight fishing. But you know, on certain conditions, if you fish in the spring or in the headwaters, in the upper rivers, for some of the smaller fish, you can definitely sight fish them. But typically, most of the time, the bigger fish, you won't be sight fishing. You know, you won't be able to see them.
Okay. Now, I have a question here that I'm going to have to quote, and I'll let you gauge your answer. You might even know this person.
Okay.
Lena Ivanova asks, do they really pull you out of the boat on a dark fall night? And is it like offering your throat to the Tuvo wolf?
I don't know who that person is who asked that question, but that obviously is someone who has been fishing with us who asked that question, and that's kind of a loaded question, and I don't think I'm at liberty to answer that here within the context of an internet interview. I could get in trouble, but with some of the language I'd have to use to describe
it. I see.
But, anyway, that's we'll go on to the next question.
Okay. Well, why don't you talk, Renee, a bit about the presentation strategies then that you use?
Yeah. Okay. Like I said, your two options of the fish swarm are we're either going to fish swarm on the surface, and that's done all, you know, during the lowest part, light part of the day, like a late evening, early morning, and nighttime. You wouldn't waste your time doing a surface presentation in the middle of the day. You might catch some smaller fish, but in terms of the larger fish, they just wouldn't be active. They just wouldn't be out during the bright part of the day. And so, you know, basically, quite often, you know, you may have to make a long cast, but generally you're not going to be casting that far. You know, if you're fishing in the dark, you're going to try to be real quiet and real careful and not spook any fish. And quite often you're going to be in areas where you can actually hear this thing in the shallows. And it can get really, really spooky because you don't want to scare the fish away and your heart's pounding and you're real nervous and you're casting in the dark. And that's not an easy thing to do. So, you know, one of the things I would recommend to anyone who wanted to go after time and the really big ones is to practice casting a good-sized fly in the dark to where you know and get a sense of what your fly is doing, because you will get absolutely, you know, it's pitch black, can't use any flashlights, so you're not going to get any visual cues. And so just from the standpoint of safety, you might want to go and practice casting in the middle of the night, just so you know what to, and also just to help in your presentation to get within range typically you're going to be out on the end of a gravel bar or maybe even off the end of the boat, and your rushing guide is going to basically put you in within range of a fish that you're going to hear splashing out there. And so it really helps if you've got some sense of where you're casting and have some ability to cast, you know, with some kind of accuracy. You're not going to have the accuracy you're going to have during the day, but at least you want to be able to cast with some kind of accuracy, and also not hook yourself on your back cast too. So
mm-hmm.
That's real important.
Yeah.
And then on your subsurface presentations, it would be much the same as dredging for kings or something up here in Alaska. you know, it's basically going to be a, you know, like a duck and chuck using real heavy lines, typically you know, 600 grain lines or more. So there's going to be nothing graceful about fishing the subsurface presentations. And typically, much the same as fishing for kings, you're going to be fishing right along bottom, some of the real deep holes, and using a real lively short strip, and bringing it in. And we're not talking, you know, obviously about making any real long casts with a setup like that. But,
sure.
You know, it's just there's not a real finesseful way of fishing, but obviously that's what it takes to get down in these deeper holes and lies where the big ones are found.
Well, Brendan in Seattle is wondering, do these fish just attack your fly without hesitation, or do they roll and boil on it, or what's their
approach? Yeah,
that's
a real interesting question, because when we first started fishing them over there, we were real quick on the take, you know, like you would be if you were fishing any other fish species over here. But quite typically, they'll come up and they'll kind of circle the if you're fishing on the surface, and even slap the thing with their tail to just kind of make sure that, you know, that's, you know, sometimes, especially if you're fishing a real big presentation or something you've tied yourself, it just moves through the water and makes a sound that attracts them, but it'll be quite unlike, or not exactly like, you know, the same sounds, the chortling sounds that, like, say, a drowning muskrat would make. So they're curious, they're real interested, but they'll come up, circle it sometimes, or slap it with their tail. So, you know, it's difficult from, you know, you're fishing in the dark or whatever to know when you've got a take or not, a grab. But you'll know when that fish grabs it and when it's time to set the hook. But my advice to guys who are just fishing is just to hold off if you can, and let the guy tell you when to set the hook. The guide will know.
Well, we need to take a little break again here, Rene. When we return, we're going to talk with Rene more about, you know, how to get that fish on the hook and what a fight with the timing is like. So we'll be back in just a second.
Matt and his crew at Dry Fly Outfitters offer a wide range of fly fishing products no matter what type of fish you're after. Whether you're looking for items for your great fishing trip or river flows or just some fly fishing information, Dry Fly Outfitters has you covered. While at their site, stop by and take a look at the World of Fly Fishing blog. There you'll find many articles and tips on fly fishing. Check out Dry Fly Outfitters now and keep checking back as they add more new items and services. You can reach Matt and the crew at www.dryflyoutfitters.com.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rene Lamaris about Siberian Timon, the legend of Russia's rivers. If you'd like to ask Rene a question, go to our homepage at www.askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Rene your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show live as we can. Well, Rene, let's say we finally located a big timon, and he's taken a look, and he's taken a hit, and we've hooked him up. What's it like? What's it like fighting a timon? How do they react?
Well, the first thing that's going to happen is he's going to bolt out into the main channel, and that's where you really got to either hold on or be prepared to chase him. And this is where most of your big fish are lost. I could tell you stories going on, but we've been, you know, out there many times late at night, and just casually picked up a rod or something and just cast it out into a pool and hooked a big fish just by pure chance. And quite a few of them in that first minute or so have been lost simply because they head out in the main channel. And, you know, since the rivers we fish do have a lot of current and lots of water, they can get away from you in no time if you don't have a boat to chase them in. this is another reason why we made our program to where we ended the last 4 or 5 days of the trip. We spend at a base camp, and we've got a motorboat to fish them, simply because it really helps to have a boat to chase a fish that gets away from you. Once they get into the main channel, they're real masters at using their body length. Timon, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, are longer for their size than salmon or trout. So typically, a large fish, 5 or 6 feet long, is going to have a real advantage in using its body in that strong current to produce an almost unbearable amount of drag on your reel and rod. And so, the chances of you getting a really big fish in from shore without some kind of boat to chase them initially are real slim, unless you're in an area where you can chase them down river on a large, unrestricted gravel bar and so forth. But after that, those initial runs in the main channel, then you'll be able to work them into a shallow or quieter section of the river. And then a lot of times they'll jump after that first initial run. They'll come straight out of the water when they're hooked sometimes, but generally they'll make a first initial run, and then they'll do some jumps. A lot of times they'll roll themselves up in the leader, and then they'll come, jumping out of the water. And quite often, if you're fishing a wire leader, they'll roll themselves up in the wire leader and then cut your line with their mouth. A lot of fish are lost that way. And then the hardest part is if you're doing to set an IGFA record, you can't use any method of, like, you can't gas a fish. You have to be real particular in the methods you use to land the fish to qualify for an IGFA record. And so it becomes real problematic when you get a really big fish in the shallows, because they're never quite spent. These fish are smart enough to save enough energy to even to fool you to think that you've got this fish that's spent, but they save enough energy to make an initial a chance at getting themselves free. And so they're not easy fish at all to deal with. And we found a lot of fishermen are just not used to the tactics of, these people come with a fishing salmon or trout. Now, salmon, if you fish salmon a lot, salmon, especially a big king, can be a real challenge, but they're not cunning in the sense that these taimen are. These taimen are calculating and cunning, and they almost wait for you to make a mistake, and then quite typically this happens at the end of the fight when you've got them, you lead them into the shallows, and you're kind of cornering this fish. Two or three guys will work around the back and try to herd this fish into the shallows while the angler is backing up on the bank. And then quite often, right at the end, this thing erupts and shoots out like an alligator, and one of the guys, dives after this thing, and he's rolling around in the shallows with this thing. It's like a gator.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just really difficult. A lot of there's been a lot of heartbreaking moments. I personally have guided guys who have tried for real light tippet class records, like an 8-pound or a tippet like that, or even lighter. And I mean, here you are, this fish, 60, 70 pounds in the shallows, and it's got the leader wrapped around, three or four times, because it's been, just fighting like a tarpon out there, and then it's in the shallows, and it looks like it's whooped, but I know, that this thing is just saving something for the very end, and it's going to wait until you try to herd this thing up on the bank, and then it's going to, all hell breaks loose, and quite often the fish is lost at that point, which is a heartbreak after a long battle, and the guy,
sure,
has gotten to that point, and then lose the fish right at the end like that. But if you're going for a line class record, you can't can't use a gaff. Now the Russians would just shoot the timon. That's how they performed. They would just shoot this thing when it jumps the first time or second time. They would shoot it, and that would be the end of it. But obviously, you know, that's not a sporting method of fishing, and the IGFA won't buy that.
Okay.
No.
When they make that first big run and hit the main current, can you give us some tips in terms of rod handling or reeling techniques to manage that?
Oh, gosh. You know, the only thing I can think of is, you know, have a really good reel with your drag set as tight as you can and run like hell or get in a boat. I mean, there's really not much else you can do. We've had fish spools in matter of like 40 or 50 seconds. I remember one time on a gravel bar, we hooked one of the guys hooked a fish and you know, and he had a real really stout setup. He was fishing I forget what I mean like 11 weight rod or 12 weight rod or something, and you know, the guy had a lot of experience fishing muskies. He was from the Midwest. The guy was just, and I was up on a bluff watching this thing, and this thing took off and just 20 or 30 seconds. That was all the guy had, and you know, we were in rafts, and you know, by the time, you know, I think we had stopped for lunch or something, and so by the time the guys had scrambled to get in the boat, and he was holding the rod up trying to. And he was in an area where it just wasn't possible to run to pursue this thing down river on foot. So, but it was really something to see this thing from up on top, and I saw the fish roll. You know, when it got down about 60 yards down below him, and you know, he just didn't have a prayer with this thing. It was just so big and in that current. So, it's a real challenge on fly fishing or fly fishermen. It's a real challenge.
What are your actual chances of new person?
Well, landing a big fish, you know, I would put the odds.
Even landing a small one, like a 30, 40 pounder.
No, the odds are really good. We have people all the time. You know, just about everyone who goes over there catches some nice fish. You know, up to 50, 60 pounds, some really, really pretty fish, and they get a real chance, a taste of what these fish can do. But nearly everyone has, or at least is around to see. You know, the big one that gets away. You know, they have this brush with this monster. You know, and it can happen late at night. It can happen in the morning. Hell, it can happen even in the middle of the day. I remember one time we were fishing on a float trip, and we had floated and had been really slow fishing all morning, and we were floating through this basically what it was a swamp, and this guy was you know, I don't know, I was asleep rowing. I was just about falling asleep because it was hot. It was in June, and we were passing by this tributary that came in, and all of a sudden this fish took his fly and came straight out of the water like Godzilla, and just scared the living crap. It was about, you know, 3 feet off the bow of the boat, and it was just so unexpected, you know. And but it was right in the middle of the day, you know. It can happen any time. And so, I mean, everyone, you know, the point
everybody's going to get a fish over there of some kind. It's not.
But in terms of a trophy of a really big time, and you know, to be quite honest with you, on a fly rod, the odds are so in that fish's favor, you know.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, the water that we fish with the current, and the being on these big rivers. Yeah, it's not easy. It's definitely not easy.
So would you say that if you had some saltwater experience with big fish, that's going to be helpful?
Oh, it definitely would be in your favor. Absolutely. Absolutely in your favor. If you were a tarpon fisherman and you were used to tangling with really big fish, the odds would definitely be vastly improved for your landing a really big fish. Or if you weren't going for, you know, the thing is that we've got catch and release policy on all the really large fish, for obvious reasons. But if you were fishing one of the fish like the Russians using, and you wanted to use a gaff or whatever like that, as I said earlier, that a lot of fish are lost right at the last part of the battle, because these are not it's not like fishing any other fish. You know, these fish, especially the really big ones, are really smart. They wouldn't have gotten to where they are if they were dumb. So they have a cunning to them that no other fish I've ever encountered has. So just because you've got this fish out of the main channel and he looks like he's tiring, you got him in the shallows. You know, I've learned from experience that the battle is far from over. You know.
Right. Right.
So,
Renee, Larry Edens in New Mexico asks, since taimen get to be very old, hence large, does catching and releasing them affect them negatively at all, like their migration patterns, spawning, and how sensitive they are to catch and release, I guess, is what he's asking.
Yeah, well, we found them to be really tough.
Really tough.
No, I mean, we initially, the first, in our early years, we were basically, letting the Russians do everything, and so, the Russians were real rough with those fish. We caught some, the first really big one we caught, the 76-pounder that my partner caught, Goo caught, they wanted to weigh the thing, and we hadn't figured out how to, now we've got a thing where you use a sling and just basically, put the fish in the sling in the water, lift it up for, a couple seconds.
Like they do tarpon, yeah.
Yeah, but, initially we had this thing, this Russian set up a tripod with these oars, and we had this big commercial scale, and we put the thing, underneath the gill and weighed this thing, and it was out of the water for, 10 minutes. All these photos were taken, and the thing did not die, I think these fish are incredibly strong and very, very tough, very hardy, but at the same time, anytime you catch a fish and tire it out like that, you have to be really, really mindful of just, after you've revived and let it go, you got to be really careful not to let it go in an area where it's going to be stressed out, just trying to maintain its position. So you want to let it go in a. So we take great pains to minimize our impact on these fish, but knowing that you could conceivably stress a fish out to the point where it just can't, you could deplete a fish to the point where it just can't make it, doesn't have the reserves to bounce back. But we have never ever seen a fish die that we've released from our fly fishing program, catch and release. Unlike fishing, I fish rainbows a lot, and I've seen rainbows just die. They fight so hard, they just die. They've fought so hard, they have absolutely nothing left, and you have a dead fish. That doesn't happen very often, but I have seen it. But never seen it happen with time, and I think they're really tough, really hardy.
Are there any kind of conservation efforts being done over there in respect to building the numbers of taimen and or keeping what's there?
Yeah, there are. In fact, in the last 5 or 10 years, there's been a joint effort on the part of the government there and also some of these conservation organizations to basically initially, the first step is just the catalog where these things are found, where, what are the major strongholds and what are the threats that are posed. And so all through the Soviet Far East, at least I know in the Far East, the Soviet Far East, the Russian government, they do have a program right now. In fact, the Wild Salmon Center is involved in some of that, some of those efforts to study some of the rivers where they're found and study also study more about the biology and life history of these fish. They're really, really fascinating fish. They're just really special.
What's the reproductive age of a taimen? One of the questions that came in during the show.
I think they're, they come, because they're so long-lived, they come real late to maturity. And I don't really, off the top of my head, know exactly how many years it is, but I'm sure it's, a good number of years compared to, let's say, a trout, let's say.
Sure.
Heck, a rainbow lives, they say, up here in Alaska, 14 years, but I'm sure that the reproductive age of a taimen, that's probably when the taimen starts to just get going in terms of his reproductive capacity at that point, yeah.
Are there any major changes that you see occurring in Russian trips over the next 20 years?
Well, like anything else, the 20-year rule, if you look at, I started guiding up here in Alaska, close to 25 years ago, and the changes I've seen in Alaska in 20 years, you know, that if you apply a 20-year rule to just about any place in terms of, you know, how the infrastructure develops and the amount of pressure, you know, it's hard to say what we're gonna have 20 years from now. But you know, one of the problems that I see with that area that where the Timon are found, at least in the Soviet Far East, is that unlike parts of Alaska and with salmon, the Timon is found is one of his you know greatest strongholds. The area that he's found, you know, like that lower Murk country that we fish, is also a prime area for other resources like forests and mineral extraction and stuff like that. And so the real problem I see there is that you know, as those industries develop and there's a call for that kind of resource development, that it could really impact the time, and more so than, let's say, fisher. You know, trying to use the analogy between what's happened here in Alaska, I see the greater threat to the time and being of the resource development in the areas that are most sensitive to, you know, where they're found in the greatest numbers. Those are the areas that are also prime areas for resource development.
Whatever. Right, and you're having that problem right now in Alaska, I understand.
Well, yeah, there is. Come to think of it, I was just thinking about that. I guess you're talking about the pebble mine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is a problem. Ultimately, I think that's the main threat to all these cold water fisheries, at least up here. It's not so much the you know, we've evolved, you know, certainly fly fishermen have evolved, and the fly fishing industry has evolved to where, you know, people by and large can you know engage in a lot of their, you know, activity, a lot of the sport with a minimal impact, certainly compared to what can happen to that resource if you have large scale open pit mines, you know, for
right.
instance. Yeah, so yeah, it's a real
yeah.
problem.
Well, hopefully they can learn from our mistakes and not get into some of the traps that we've gotten ourselves.
Yeah, the only problem there, of course, is, you know, the economic factors that drive your decisions. They don't have the environmental awareness and the luxury of the environmental community that we have over
right.
here. They take a little bit harder line to everything because you know, they're a lot more desperate for economic
right.
development.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Renee, has there been any efforts to, one of the questions came in while we were live on the show, any efforts to bring Timon to North American waters?
I'd love to do that. I've tried. The problem is, you know, quite frankly, it would be a lot easier for you to sneak a nuclear bomb into this country, at least the state of Alaska, than it would be to try to ship a live salmonid into the
yeah.
state of Alaska, I'll tell you, because, you know, for one thing, Fish and Wildlife, you know, those guys are at least in here, if you try, you know, U.S. Customs here in Anchorage, I don't know what it's like in Seattle or L.A. or some other points of entry, but, man, I'll tell you what, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here in Anchorage, like I said, you'd have a much better chance of getting a bomb in here, a nuclear bomb, than a live salmon. They are on all that stuff and the permitting and all this other stuff. It would be very, very, very difficult. And also, at least from the standpoint of the state of Alaska, they have a real strong policy of keeping out any invasive species. So,
right. Well, we have that issue everywhere, and
yeah,
it's really probably the wrong thing to do. But
it would be wonderful. We have a lot of rivers in interior Alaska that I think would be ideally suited for Siberian Timon, and plus it would be a great boost for tourism, since they don't have the diversity of fishing in the interior that they have along the coast. They don't have good salmon fishing. I could just see the signs of billboard
yeah.
signs along the highway. Fish Joe's in pond. You know, for Siberian Timon, you know, right, you know, you have a big thing painted on the sign. You know.
Well, we can only wish, I guess. But,
yeah,
well.
I'd love to. They're so, I would love to to have some and propagate them over. They're really, to me, I find them to be most fascinating.
Well, for now, I guess we'll have to travel to Russia and join you over there. So, well, unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up here. We've run out of time, but when we return, stick with us here, Renee. When we return, we're going to give away that autographed copy of your book, Alaska Fishing.
Good.
And we're also be giving away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, a Canadian journal. So stay tuned to see if you win.
This segment of our show is brought to you by Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California. Featuring classes on all aspects of fly fishing, Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com, that's K-I-E-N-E.com, or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. On our events calendar tonight, we see a casting clinic at the Great Western Fly Fishing Company in Loveland, Colorado. That starts at 10 a.m. on Saturday, October 14th. You can go to the events calendar to Colorado for contact information. And remember, list any fly fishing related events yourself on our events calendar. Each show, we will select one event to highlight. And don't forget to remind your local clubs and fly shops to list their fly fishing-related happenings on the events calendar.
Well, just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think about this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away an autographed copy of Alaska
book,
Fishing,
Alaska
the Fishing
Angler's Guide.
The book is the most comprehensive guide to fishing the 49th state. This deluxe full-color edition covers all Alaska species, methods, and waters with contributions from Alaska's top fishing experts. And if you don't win tonight, you can still order an autographed copy of Renee's book at his website, ultimaterivers.com, at a reduced price of $25. Normally it's $34.95. So after the show, if you don't win, just go to his website, ultimaterivers.com, and you can place your order there. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected on this show's from this show's registration database, and if you didn't register for tonight's show by now, then it's too late. But make sure you do so for our next show. You don't want to miss out on the chance to win some of the incredible prizes we have to offer. So if you're the lucky winner tonight, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So here it goes, Renee. We're going to draw for your book here, and we'll just press the magic button. And the winner is Scott LePage in North Carolina. So congratulations, Scott LePage.
Great.
And I'm sure you enjoy the book. If you haven't been to Alaska, this will make you want to go. So a great place to go fishing. So thanks, Renee, for that contribution. We appreciate it. And we're also giving away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, Canada's premier fly fishing magazine. And so I'll go ahead and pick the winner for that. And Mark Kulikov of in California. So Mark will get you set up to receive that subscription, and we'll contact both you gentlemen after the show to get your addresses and so forth that we need to get the prizes out to you.
We can bet that those folks are going to enjoy the prizes they've won. Renee, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us tonight, and I want to thank you for teaching us more about the Siberian taiman and fishing in the wilderness in Russia, and hope that you'll be able to join us again for another show sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to, and I it was a real pleasure for me to be here and to be able to share some of this information about these interesting fish with your listeners. So
very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Renee. And on our next broadcast, we will be, which will be on October 18th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, we'll interview Brad Beefus, and our topic for the show will be carp on the fly. Carp are a terrific challenge for fly fishers everywhere, so listen in and learn all about these elusive fish. We'd like to thank R.L. Winston Rod Company, Front Range Anglers, Jaeger's Fly Shop, Dry Fly Outfitters, and Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our site, like the events calendar and the directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.